Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The death toll in Chile rose to nearly 800 today as the country continues its recovery efforts from Saturday's earthquake. Coming as it did on the heels of the disaster in Haiti, aid groups are wondering whether and when donor fatigue might set in. At the very least, there's no word yet of a celebrity telethon. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, offering cloud computing for businesses with solutions for managing the transition to the cloud while managing costs for customers at microsoft.com/cloud services. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, who is on jury duty. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It is the second day of March. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton visited earthquake-ravaged Chile today. She brought with her 25 satellite telephones for use in areas where communications are still down, and she promised more aid. Argentina, Brazil, and Peru have also sent assistance, as have nonprofits and charities from all over the world. But as with previous 1-2 punch disasters, there is concern about donor fatigue, with the Chilean crisis coming so soon after the tragedy in Haiti. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Compared to the relief effort for Haiti, charitable giving for Chile's earthquake victims has been slower.
Donations to Chile have not been very significant. I think so far only about $500,000 raised.
That's Una Ocelli, Director of Research at the Center on Philanthropy at Indiana University. She says the smaller number of fatalities in Chile and its geographic distance from the U.S. may have cut into donations. Plus, Chile itself initially sent the wrong signals.
If the government comes out early to say, oh, we don't really need very much help, that's obviously going to have an impact on the intensity of the fundraising effort.
But not everyone is disappointed with charitable giving for Chile.
We noticed a spike in online visits as early as 6:30 in the morning on Saturday.
Randy Strash coordinates fundraising for the charity World Vision.
We've raised $450,000. That's as of yesterday noon, which is pretty good for a weekend and half a day.
In the short term, World Vision is distributing blankets and medicine. Eventually, the organization will help Chile reboot its economy.
There's a secondary disaster that occurs after a major disaster, and that's all these businesses come to a screeching halt, and people don't have work to go to, and they don't get paid.
The real donor fatigue may still be to come. Once an issue fades from the media spotlight, it attracts fewer donations. Rebuilding in Chile, as in Haiti, will take at least 5 years. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Today, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood said the government may require every new car to have a braking system that overrides the gas pedal. LaHood's testimony followed an announcement from federal safety officials that the number of deaths from sudden acceleration of Toyotas has increased from 34 to 52. Since September, the Japanese car company has recalled some 6 million cars in the U.S. John Dimsdale reports on the changes still to come.
Many cars sold in the U.S. already have a system where the brakes override the accelerator. GM cars do, says spokesman Greg Martin, but that doesn't mean the company is ready to embrace a government mandate.
What we don't want to do is rush to any definitive position on requirements before we know what those requirements may be.
Fords, Honda Acuras, Audis, and Mercedes are among the cars that already have brake overrides. But not Toyotas, says Washington Post automotive columnist Warren Brown.
Toyota routinely mass install safety systems such as airbags and that sort of thing after some other manufacturer developed not only a performance history for those systems, but a litigation history for those systems. Toyota routinely tries to avoid that. So it is usually less to install those systems.
Meanwhile, the Detroit Free Press reported today GM is considering putting its electric hybrid prototype, the Chevy Volt, into the hands of a few consumers early to test it out and get consumer feedback. But GM's John Hughes says, don't worry, the testing won't be done on public highways.
It is with another GM engineer or GM person in the vehicle with them. So we're not setting the vehicles loose to say, hey, listen, here, take a car and let me know what you think.
So he says GM isn't putting the public at risk. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The latest word on a new consumer watchdog agency for financial products is that it would become part of the Federal Reserve. President Barack Obama has said repeatedly that he wants an independent agency. But as we outlined on yesterday's show, the financial industry is doing everything it can to stop that idea. We wondered where consumer sentiment lies for an idea that's designed to protect them. Reporter Brett Neely went in search of an answer.
Mail in favor of an independent financial watchdog for consumers is flooding Capitol Hill, says one Senate staffer. Travis Plunkett at the Consumer Federation of America says, just look at the polls.
Americans have been asked again and again about this, and it's pretty clear that they want a watchdog that's focused only on protecting them.
He says consumers want protection from dangerous financial products. Richard Sanner is a retired minister in Surrey, Maine.
I know I don't understand some of the stuff, and I have a bachelor's and master's degree in management, and I've taught economics.
Sanner says he's seen members of his church get burned by high fees and even higher interest rates.
25-30% interest rate, that's usury. That's outrageous.
Constance Bevitt of Silver Spring, Maryland, is worried the Senate will neuter the idea.
I would hate to see them become just another agency lost in, you know, the bowels of the federal government somewhere.
But there's plenty of skepticism about whether the government is even up to the task. Patrick McGuire lives in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm for the idea. I'm for the principle. However, I'm not certain that they're going to be able to make it succeed.
McGuire just finished teaching a class of fifth graders about managing money. He says they get it.
I heard some more intelligent questions and debates from the fifth graders than I've heard from the politicians and on the news programs.
To avoid a repeat of the financial mess, McGuire is pinning his hopes on education, not on a new agency. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
There was plenty of conversation about Wall Street today, a little less action on it. Details when we do the numbers. This week, we're assessing the state of the Black Union, the challenges facing African Americans in this new decade. Today, a look at jobs. Congress and the White House are trying to hammer out an employment bill to get Americans back to work and stimulate the economy. The national unemployment rate is hovering around 10%. Commentator Margaret Sims says that's a number that would spark envy in the Black community.
In January, the rate for African Americans was nearly 17%, compared with roughly 9% for white workers. Newsflash, this 2-to-1 ratio is the norm. As I see it, the reason African Americans are out in the cold when it comes to jobs boils down to three words: location, location, location. Many African Americans live in cities like Cleveland or Detroit, that prospered during the heyday of heavy manufacturing, but have struggled as the economy has transitioned to new industries like high tech. And those that do find themselves in areas with strong economic growth, like Los Angeles or Atlanta, have historically been isolated to parts of town with little or no opportunities. To get African Americans back to work in this country, three things need to happen. Both federal and local governments need to attract employers to African American neighborhoods. This would provide jobs and fuel local economies. Financial incentives like tax breaks would be a good way to go. More job training opportunities need to be available to retrain those who are out of work. The problem? Federal dollars for workforce programs have been falling for the last two decades, and all at a time when jobs that pay decent wages are increasingly requiring higher skills. This is a service that must and could be funded right now by new stimulus dollars. Finally, we need more of an investment in education. President Obama has already earmarked money for school reform. But this is not enough. State representatives and local school board members, people we elect, need to be on the hook too. Can you imagine the changes we'd see if these officials' re-election possibilities were tied to academic achievements of African American students? We need to answer the question of how to get African Americans back to work right now if America is to remain a leader in the global economy. And to do that, it's got to stop leaving people in its own country behind.
Margaret Sims is a fellow at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. Listen for more this week about solutions to the challenges African Americans are facing. And if you've got an idea you'd like to share, visit marketplace.org. Today is a holiday in India. It's called, appropriately enough, Holi. The Hindu festival marks the coming of spring, and on the streets, people smear each other with brightly colored powder. But in the Indian capital, Delhi, some of the poorest residents aren't in a celebratory mood. They're angry that city bosses, wanting to spruce up the metropolis, plan to hire private contractors to collect trash from the streets. From Delhi, Raymond Thibodeau reports.
Bole Kashyap sorts through bags of trash for aluminum cans, glass bottles, cardboard boxes, anything he can sell to junk dealers. He came to Delhi as a young man 15 years ago to work as a cook, but this is as far as he got, a rag picker, more like a freelance recycler. It's a job he hates, but even at $2 a day, it's still a job.
I've never seen it this bad. We used to earn 350 rupees a day. Now it's down to about 100, which is just not good enough. So now my wife and my children must work alongside me. I've had to take my four children out of school.
His anger is directed at Delhi's city government. The city's handing off some of its responsibilities to private contractors, everything from bus service to trash collection. That means trash pickers like Bole are barred from collecting garbage in areas of the city that have already been privatized. Soon, the entire city will be off limits. In Delhi alone, there are as many as 250,000 who make their living off of what others throw away.
Everything is getting handled by private operators who have no use for the poor. There are no jobs for us anymore because of the government's decision to privatize. We have to run away from Delhi.
More and more cities across the country are privatizing municipal tasks in hopes of saving money while improving services for residents. Bharati Chaturvedi is director for Chintan, a charity that supports rag pickers.
Trash has become an especially valuable commodity in our country. We're talking of displacing hundreds of thousands of small private players in favor of just two or three really large players.
Because those large players, the private companies, have first rights to the garbage, people like Bole are being shut out of the system.
That's unfortunate because a lot of the small players are able to provide personalized services. They recycle 2,000 tons of waste every single day in the city of Delhi. So why throw them out?
City officials say they don't want to throw anyone out. On the contrary, they've urged private waste companies to hire the rag pickers. Parth Shah is president of the Center for Civil Society. He agrees with the decision to privatize trash collection because city trash workers weren't doing a good job. On any given day, nearly 40% of trash collectors don't bother showing up for work. As an alternative, Shah says the rag pickers could form their own companies.
We have suggested to the government in other cities to also organize them as a cooperative. Let them bid for the contract. They know how to run this service. This is what they've been doing for the last 20, 30 years.
In the meantime, Bole and his family walk past the trash collection areas that are now closed off to them. Bole says he hates seeing so much good waste going to waste. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Coming up, a job action threatens a miner's livelihood.
I love my job. I mean, where else can I go and play with overgrown Tonka trucks, really?
But first, let's do the numbers. Today on Wall Street, the Dow ticked up 2 points, basically flat, to finish at 10,405. The NASDAQ climbed 7 points, 1/3 of a percent, to close at 2280. And the S&P 500 added 2 points, 1/4 of a percent, to end the day at 1118. Credit cards were approved by investors after a bullish statement from the CEO of American Express. Amex lifted 2/3 of a percent. Capital One charged up 1 2/3 percent. Visa dropped 0.4 percent. Tech stocks powered down today. Microsoft lost nearly 2%. IBM, Hewlett-Packard, and Intel were each down 0.8 percent. Qualcomm says it'll buy back as many as 3 million of its shares. The mobile phone maker dialed up 6 2/3 percent. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.61%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Microsoft, offering cloud computing for businesses with solutions for managing the transition to the cloud while managing costs for customers at Microsoft.com/cloud services. And by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations about Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's going on tomorrow. In Washington, the Federal Reserve publishes its latest beige book summary of current economic conditions. Twitterless? Still using the telephone to communicate? Let's thank inventor Alexander Graham Bell, born on March 3, 1847. And the winter clothes you wear now are almost so totally passé. Look ahead to next fall winter ready-to-wear styles on the runway during Paris Fashion Week. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We tip off letters today with basketball, or at least a look behind the locker room wall. 2 weeks ago, we interviewed sports writer Mark Yost about corruption in college sports. The conversation revolved around the sometimes less than ideal outcomes for those who don't go pro. Jen O'Reilly of San Francisco is a six-time NCAA All-American in track, and she was outraged at what Mr. Yost left out.
I was appalled at the one-sexed, micro-focused analysis of college sports. The NCAA sponsors 23 sports for men and women across three divisions. Mr. Yost should be more precise when damning college sports as not being focused on the athletes. That is just not the case for the majority of us.
Karen Hamilton of Escondido, California was miffed as well.
This piece never mentions the stark contrast in graduation rates when comparing women's and men's teams. Please don't refer to college athletics if you mean men's college athletics.
So we put in another call to Mr. Yost. He says there's a reason women don't come up in discussions about corruption in college sports.
They're not corrupted. It's the money of the men's sports that really leads people astray.
While we're on the topic of money and competition, last week we covered that big healthcare summit in Washington, and a couple of lines from our reporter got your dander up.
many Americans don't have a good sense of those costs. Most of us get our insurance through our employers. The premiums are deducted automatically from our paychecks. We're disconnected from the cost of health care.
Actually, many of you said, I know exactly what I spend on health care, and it's a lot. Others of you admitted, she's right, and you have no idea. Whatever the cost, Chris Merrill of Raleigh, North Carolina, says he's thinking less about dollar signs and more about solutions to the problem. He says the fix to health care is all about competition, and he points to LASIK eye surgery as proof.
It is not covered by most health care. People have to spend their own money for it. When faced with this, they shop around and look for the best deal. Apply this to the rest of the healthcare system, and you have the solution.
And finally, a note about a commentary we ran last week from Youth Radio's Lauren Silverman. She described how the financial crisis made her rethink her dream of working on Wall Street. Ben Gustafson of Framingham, Massachusetts, has a word of advice.
There are plenty of career choices and industries and companies that actually add value to people's lives. Think big.
We want your thoughts, big and small. To share them, go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. New York City is distinguished by many an amazing feature: the Empire State Building, Broadway, Lady Liberty. As of today, you can add a feature that no city would boast about, a new Superfund site. The Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn now has the dubious distinction of ranking among the country's most hazardous waste sites. The label clears the way for cleanup of the polluted waterway, but the city says it also threatens much-needed development in the area. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
The nearly 2-mile Gowanus Canal snakes through an old industrial section of Brooklyn. The chemical plants and coal yards are gone, but local artist Eric Ost says they left plenty behind.
I'm sure that the first 3 feet of sediment under there is saturated with all kinds of chemicals.
Pesticides, heavy metals, and PCBs, to be exact. By designating the canal a Superfund site, the Environmental Protection Agency can force polluters to pay for the cleanup. The city of New York had its own plan, to be paid in part by voluntary contributions from polluters. City officials say the Superfund process may take longer, open up legal battles, and scare off potential developers.
It's like putting a smallpox designation on someone's front door.
Bill Appel directs the Gowanus Canal Community Development Corporation. He fears banks won't lend money to fund affordable housing projects near the Superfund site. Today, the luxury developer Toll Brothers confirmed it's abandoning plans to build condos in the neighborhood. But the EPA's Walter Mugden says any stigma was already there.
It smells. You can see oily sheens on the water at any day of the year. And we think that actually the prospect of now getting it cleaned up in a reasonable period of time may actually reduce whatever stigma there was attached to it.
Even a reasonable period could mean 10 to 12 years, with a price tag of up to $500 million. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
California's most famous mineral is, or at least was, the gold in them thar hills. But dig a little deeper in the state's high desert and you'll strike borax. For the tiny town of Boron, the mineral that you probably know best as a laundry detergent is a way of life, home to one of the biggest borax mines in the world. As April Lunston reports, it's also now the site of a standoff between a powerful mining company and more than a quarter of the town's residents who work in the mine.
Terry Judd has worked at the Rio Tinto borax mine for 13 years. It's just one piece of a multi-billion dollar mining empire operated on six continents by the British company Rio Tinto Group. Judd runs a front loader in an open pit big enough to hold all the pyramids in Egypt. She scoops up piles of the chalky mineral and brings them to the surface to be crushed.
I love my job. I mean, where else can I go and play with overgrown Tonka trucks, really?
On a recent Sunday, Judd arrived at the mine to find she was among 560 hourly workers locked out of their jobs.
To go to work and to being told, no, you cannot come into work, you know, it broke my heart.
It also was a big blow to the psyche of this town about 100 miles north of Los Angeles. The history of boron and the mine have been largely inseparable since a doctor drilling a well discovered borax in the area almost a century ago. Since the late 20s, the borax unearthed from the mine has been a source of civic pride, turning up in enamel goods, fiberglass, cosmetics, and even a popular detergent additive.
20 Mule Team Borax has been improved. Now it's Borateam.
Barbara Pratt moved to boron from Oklahoma with her family in 1932. She was 12.
This is the depth of the Depression, and this is one place where my dad could get a job.
Pratt, now 87, runs the 20 Mule Team Museum. It features exhibits about the town, the mine, and the team of 18 mules and two horses that used to cart loads of borax out of the desert. She recalls her dad's strong loyalty to the mine.
My dad had emphysema, so he got to the point where he really couldn't work as a foreman anymore. So they put him in the guardhouse at the gate and paid him the same wages that he had. I don't know how many companies would do that, but they did.
Now, with the lockout, Terry Judd says she's not sure that kind of loyalty exists anymore.
You know, I have to say I've lost confidence in the company itself.
Judd's father and grandfather both worked for the mine, and she had plans to stay there until she retired. Now she's not sure, and she worries about the future of the community.
By locking out their workers, the families in town, they're losing money. And when the families lose money, the community loses money.
The origins of the dispute stretch back to September, when unionized workers at the mine began negotiating with Rio Tinto management on a new labor contract. Rio Tinto wants to change the union's seniority-based promotion system, and it wants the right to hire non-union workers. The International Longshore and Warehouse Union said no, and in January, Rio Tinto locked out all union members. They've been replaced by non-union workers from other Rio Tinto facilities. The company's owned the mine for 40 years, and while there have been strikes in the past, this is the first lockout.
So these big balls go up and fall down and knock it loose.
Bob Deal is part of the mine's management team. On a recent tour of the facility, Deal says he's troubled by the standoff and hopes it's resolved soon.
I know a lot of people just by being here a long period of time, a lot of people that live in town. You know, I feel I have a stake in the community.
But Deal says Rio Tinto needs labor flexibility to stay competitive. The company's lost 25% of its share in the global borax market, due in large part to competition from a government-owned mine in Turkey. Rio Tinto General Manager Dean Gehring says the company's proposed changes to the labor contract would actually benefit the local economy.
The best way that we can preserve jobs here for the long term and make our business as successful as possible is to have this new contract update our business practices. That's going to preserve more jobs and help the community more than continuing to operate under the old contract.
For now, union leaders are digging in their heels. They've organized donation drives among the union's 42,000 members around the country. And there are plans to send a caravan of cars and trucks from Los Angeles, with $30,000 worth of food and supplies for the locked-out workers. In Boron, California, I'm April Lunston for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice Independent Insurance Agents, offering a choice of companies and coverage. You can find a local agent at 1-800-WE-INSURE. By Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, reality has intruded on the latest cable reality show. A&E has been following around various employees of New York's Metropolitan Transportation Authority, documenting the lives of conductors, token takers, and others who get the city's commuters safely from one stop to another. But tough economic times mean the MTA needs workers to be fully focused on their jobs. So, much like the subway lines themselves, sometimes there will be a delay in the project. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow ticked up 2 points, basically flat. The NASDAQ climbed 7 points, 1/3%. The S&P 500 added 2 points, 1/4%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins, Doug Krisner, and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, could being a successful entrepreneur be in your DNA?
About a third to 40% of the tendency to be an entrepreneur is innate.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.